When Republicans talk about the State of the Union, they're very aware that it's a union of states. We had hoped to have three of our more prominent governors with us today, but they were caught in a large snowstorm in the Midwest. We have, though, a number of members of Congress who are distinguished leaders of that body and who have a great deal to say about the course and direction of our legislation. From the state of New Mexico, Senator Peter Domenici is one of our younger and more aggressive members. The Republican leader of the House of Representatives, Congressman John Rhodes. The Republican minority leader of the Senate, Senator Howard Baker from Tennessee. Representative Millicent Fenwick from New Jersey. One of our more attractive members and more able members, Representative Barbara Carnival from New York State on the Ways and Means Committee. A principal part of President Carter's message on the State of the Union dealt with the need to reduce taxes in this country. I think that's something that Republicans very much agree with. But we do have concern about the President's bill, about his proposal, and whether, in fact, it does cut taxes for the average American. We've been fighting for the last year to enact tax cuts across the board for all Americans, and time and again, our efforts have been defeated by the Democrat majority in the Congress and even threatened by a presidential veto. John Rhodes, you've been deeply involved in the fight, and I wonder if you could just kick off the discussion with a conversation first of some of the concerns we have with the President's tax cut and why we propose a much larger and more extensive cut.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm very pleased to be here and to have the opportunity with my colleagues in the House and the Senate and yourself to talk about problems that I think are very important. And the President's tax program actually does not add up to a tax cut. And I think that this is something the American people should know. The $25 billion which the President proposes actually does not take put as much back in the pockets of the taxpayer as the Congress, the Democratic Congress, and the President have previously taken out because of the passage of the Social Security bill. One of the problems that the President's bill has is that even if it's adopted, it doesn't go into effect until October 1st, and of course, all of that time, the Social Security tax, having been increased, will result in American taxpayers having a smaller take-home pay than they previously had. Also, I think it's important for everybody to understand that with the type of tax system that we have, progressive, that as inflation takes over, as we get more and more inflation, and in spite of the fact that the President said that inflation was going down in his State of the Union message, that is, those are not the facts. I wish they were, but there are no indicators that that point that way at all. It's going up, and it does cause the taxes of the American people to go up, because if your income in dollars goes up, then you get into a higher bracket, and there is an actual accretion in dollars to the federal government because of inflation, which is wrong. That's not the right way to handle it. So we think that, in fact, our experts tell us that if we were to take care of those two things, the impact of inflation and the impact of the Social Security tax increase, it would take a $31 billion tax cut, or a $51 billion tax cut. If we just took care of inflation, it would be $31 billion. Now, we think that the best way to cut taxes, and we're in favor of a tax cut, have been for many months. In fact, we welcome President Carter to the club. We started the club long before he did. We think that it should be a 10% across-the-board tax cut every year for 3 years. This would have the effect, of course, of giving everybody the same percentage cut. It would help the American taxpayer because he'd have more to spend. And I think, quite importantly, it would help to solve one of the most pressing problems we have in this country, which is capital expansion. In order to do all of the things which we want to do, in order to provide jobs for people, to provide the lifestyle which Americans want, we've got to increase our industrial plant. To do this, we have to form capital. The President's program, nowhere in the President's program do we see anything but just casual mention of capital formation. So that's the, those are, I think, in a nutshell, the main problems.
You know, to summarize, the problem that we have in this country is that there are millions of people that are out of work. And And it isn't that they don't want to work. They simply can't find a job because there is not a job available. If you look at that fact, if you look at the fact that 6+ million people can't find jobs, if you look at the fact that over 20% of our young people can't find jobs, if you look at the fact that over 37% of minority young people, blacks, Puerto Ricans, and others like that, you have to understand that this Congress and this government must begin to take tangible steps to deal with it. I think the genius of what we're trying to do in the Republican approach, our bill would create 1 million jobs in the first year. By 1980, 4 million jobs would be created. And that's quite a different approach from what the president has proposed.
And that's in the private sector, not the make-work jobs that the president has proposed.
That's exactly right. They're not temporary jobs, and they're not welfare jobs or public service that don't last at minimum wage, but they're fundamental jobs for a lifetime. And that's where, Barbara, I think we've come down to the crux of the question.
One of the most disappointing things about the president's statement was that he indicated it was going to reduce taxes for 96% of the people. And that would be true if you looked at it as if that were the only tax. But as John mentioned, the Social Security tax has gone up very substantially. The president's also proposed energy taxes, which John didn't mention. We don't know how that's going to turn out. His Democratic leaders in Congress have not been able to work out the compromise on that. And it's probable that that's going to take money out of the economy, too.
But, yes, because do you remember in the debate on the floor, it was revealed that I think it was the net take out of the pockets of the American people of $52 billion.
That's
the energy tax alone. Yeah.
Bill, let me look at it with you and with our people from another angle. You know, we speak of wanting the enterprise system to grow, and John's addressed one aspect of that. But actually, the other aspect is the productivity of our people. And what concerns me is that the forgotten class in America, that special interest group we don't talk about, are the working men and women. If they lose their initiative and their pride and their desire to work and get ahead, then this system isn't going to work. And unless we address a tax cut to them, saying there is something to be gained by your working hard, you can get ahead, then this system's going to fall apart. And from what I understand, in about 3 years, anyone that today is earning $12,500 will actually be paying more taxes rather than less. So they're not getting a tax cut. When the full brunt of Social Security, inflation, and the other things hit, they will be taking a step backwards. So I think the people and their productivity and their desire to get up and go to work, to add a family member to the energy of this enterprise system, which will put other people to work, is really at stake. I hear that more than any other thing in my state, and I think it's everywhere. The working people making a good living are saying, we want our country to help others, but who's worried about us? We can't pay for our children to go to college. We can't remodel our homes. And yet we're working hard every day, and we get it socked to us. I think that's a big, big issue.
That's fundamentally what is wrong with the president's plan. He says that he would cut taxes for the American people, 96% of the American people. That is an inaccurate statement. It just is not valid. If you look at the real facts on the merit, out of the studies made by our Democrat-run Congressional Budget Office, taxes are going to increase on the average family. Any family making $12,000, $500 more, that's the majority of the American people. The people that are hit hardest are multi-earner families, but where the wife also works because she has to. With this government creating inflation as bad as it is and raising taxes, women have had to go to work to supplement the family income. So that family really gets caught. The second group that gets hit are single people, and these are our young people. They're given a disincentive to work,
right?
Because what the president has done is to say he's going to cut taxes, and he has below $12,500, but that's a minority of people, and then he steeply increases the progressivity of the tax effect on families because they're hit with inflation and the progressive tax table. And That in itself is inflationary. We simply, as a government, have not come to grips with this problem of inflation. And if you look at the budget figures are so understated, they themselves are going to make inflation worse in this country instead of better. And what is
there? Let me say one thing, though. There, you know, CBS has given us time to, in effect, reply to the President's State of the Union from a Republican point of view. And I think the country will, I think all of us do, take account of the fact that a tax cut is a basic fundamental tenet of Republican economic policy in this country now. And I'm sure nobody really is going to forget that back last spring that the Republican caucus in the Senate unanimously adopted a proposal for a tax cut instead of a $50 rebate. And I said then, as you did and as John Rhodes did, look, we want the president to embrace our point of view. I said the other day, John, as you and I were on another forum, that when the president proposed his tax cut, that he was singing our song, and we'll make room for him in the choir. But he hadn't learned the words yet. And we've got to make sure that that tax cut goes to the men and women, as Pete Domenici says, who are the forgotten class, that it goes to produce the capital that's available for investment, that it goes to produce the stimulation to create new jobs, as you say, Bill, that when we take that expensive but necessary step, that Republican initiative that we proposed last spring and that Jimmy Carter and his administration violently disagreed with.
Howard, you had me start that.
Oh, I did indeed. Domenici was one of the leaders in our caucus in proposing an alternative. And I'll take just another moment to say, because I think all of us here at one time or the other have discussed the nature of politics, I happen to have a great respect for political parties, notwithstanding their acute public distress from time to time. I think they're essential. And I think there's a responsibility of a political party in the United States not only to criticize a president's program, but to offer an alternative. And I think the Republican Party operated in a responsible and respectable way when it proposed this tax cut last year. And I'm delighted that President Carter has come along. But now it's up to us to show him what we meant when we suggested it in the first instance.
Let me tell you just for a second what the Republicans did propose, because it's important. We didn't propose a $25 billion tax cut over just a short period of time, 1 year. We proposed a staged tax cut that would amount to $151 billion over 3 years, phasing it in because that's the responsible way to do it. But for the family at $8,000 a year, Barb, if I remember, it was a 90% cut in taxes. For the family at $10,000, it was a 49% cut in taxes. For the family at $12,000, it was a cut of 38%. So the people that are working in America could have an opportunity to maintain their sustenance at home and take care of their children, which is really what this country is all about.
Bill, it's difficult to define the middle class in America. I define them as people who don't want something from government. But that's the group that's been terribly robbed by inflation and its impact on the graduated income tax that John Rhodes talked about. And I think one important point to make is that a substantial tax cut is needed just to keep taxes where they are.
That's correct.
Because there's a real increase in taxes as a result of the impact of inflation on the graduated income tax. And the brackets come very close together for people between $15,000 and $50,000. In other words, you move into a higher bracket quite quickly and you get a real increase in taxes, even though your dollars are worth less. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the things that needs to be compensated, not as a matter of stimulating the economy, not as a matter of improving the investment climate, because they're the people that do the investing for the most part, but just as a matter of simple tax equity. How do we get these people from having their taxes gradually escalated to the point where they give up all hope of ever getting ahead?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's important that we make a point right now, because there are people watching this program who are probably saying to themselves, these Republicans are talking about a bigger tax cut and they usually talk about balancing a budget. Now, have they changed their spots? Well, the answer is no, we haven't changed our spots. We certainly do intend to balance a budget, and we need to point out a phenomenon which occurred in the 1960s. And you'll all remember that during the Kennedy administration, a tax cut was promulgated, and I have to admit that at the time I didn't quite believe that it would end up with a balanced budget. I'm not even sure but what I voted against it. But nevertheless, it did end up with a balanced budget, and it is true that with the type of tax system that we have, dependent as it is on the velocity of the economy, that you can actually get more federal dollars in by stimulating the economy, and you come closer to balancing the budget with a tax cut than you will without. And furthermore, it's been Republican doctrine that, in fact, as Barb, you know, in that legislative agenda that we put out in 75, we're going to put out another one, you had a lot to do with it, we said that as far as the House is concerned, the first Republican Congress that we have, we're going to spend the first session in doing nothing except legislative oversight. Now, Democrats never heard of legislative oversight. When a Congress creates a new agency or a new program, the Congress is prone to just let it alone, let the executive take care of it, put out the regulations, do whatever they please, and Congress forgets it and goes on and creates other agencies. Well, we think it's time that Congress look backward at the agencies that have already been created and do away with a lot of them. Do away with a lot of the harassment of the American people, and incidentally, save a lot of tax dollars. So, we intend to balance the budget in two ways. We're going to cut the size of this government, and also we are going to, by cutting taxes, actually increase the velocity of the economy and bring the revenues to a point where there will be a meeting.
But John, if you remember back in 1976, Mendelson, when the president was running for the presidency, one of the most important promises he made to the American people was he was going to do what we've been asking.
That's right.
And that is to go back and check on government and see what isn't working and cut it out. It's called zero-based budgeting. It's something we've been trying for a long time to get, not quite in that label, but the same thing. And yet, where is it today? It's not in the budget.
Anywhere. And something else that's very much missing is a kind of common sense approach. You know, the other day in the banking committee, it was very amusing. One of the members of the banking committee said to one of the representatives of one of the agencies, "Don't you and HUD ever talk to the people in the Treasury?" Well, you know, if we're really concerned, and we must be, about the unemployment in our cities, for example, I think that those who are concerned with those unemployment programs should perhaps talk to the tax people. Because maybe what we need is to take some of this money that we spend anyway in these programs of public service jobs, which are all done in a year and don't seem to lead very far because the retention is something like 15% in getting any real job, and use that as a tax incentive to in businesses in those areas where we have thousands and thousands of unemployed people. You know, John ought to talk to Henry. I mean, we've got to get them together. And this is what this kind of separation between the agencies, I think, accounts for a lot of what I call counterproductive measures. One measure seems to say, yes, we've got to do this, and another measure frustrates the effects of that one.
Yeah. Bill, I want to say two points on this issue. We're going to get a new urban policy, supposedly. I worked in city problems for quite a while, and I'm firmly convinced that until you tie an economic development program to an urban policy, that you are going to build sidewalks and buildings and a community center, but you're not going to, in 10 years, have people using it and living there. And I hope that any program that the president comes forth for our inner cities with problems, that we be objective on why they fell apart.
Exactly.
And they fell apart because the economic base that gave sustenance to the livelihood of those people is gone. And if the leaders in those communities will face that forthrightly and ask that we help them through tax measures and otherwise to bring back the base for justification for living and existing there, rather than merely to pump dollars in to build public buildings, we may be on the road. Bill, before I finish, I want to tell you one thing for the American people. You know, Keynesian economics, the kind we've been practicing for a long time, says take your money take it from you, bring it to the government, and then let the government make decisions where and how to spend it. And as it spends, it stimulates. Tax cutting is a theory that says leave it in the pocket of the one that earned it and let him spend it. And when he spends it, the ripple is across the economic board rather than taking the risk of the government making these huge mistakes with programs with our money that we're supposed to stimulate that did little or no good but took from the collective American taxpayer.
Pete, there's a point that has to be made there. Republican tax cuts are also accompanied by restraint in spending. The president said in his State of the Union address that he was going to reduce the deficit slightly. You know how much he reduced it? He reduced it from $62 billion to $61 billion. And I really think we ought to look at that budget some before we see if it's a real reduction or not. But obviously, he doesn't believe in the kind of spending restraint which should be the other side of the coin if you're going to have a tax cut. That's the way you transfer money from the government's pocket to the pocket of the people.
That's correct.
Because otherwise, you're going to have to borrow that money and ultimately take it away from them in inflation, which has been so much a part of Democratic policy.
Barbara, were you in the budget committee, I think it was yesterday, when the director of the Office of Management and Budget testified? I wasn't there, but I'm told that he's a very fine young man. I like him. I think he's going to do a good job. But the Democrats on the committee especially asked him about zero-based budgeting. You know, this was big in the Carter campaign. And he said, oh, yes, they had gone with zero-based budgeting. And so he said, we made everybody set forth their priorities. And one of the members said, how much did you cut out because of zero-based budgeting? And he said, I can't answer that question. and actually, although the plan apparently is in place, it hadn't been implemented because there aren't people there who want to cut the budget. That's true of our budget committee. We've got a fine setup, but it's just like a great big beautiful 747 airplane out at the end of the runway. Until you put gas in it, it doesn't go. And neither does the budget committee until you put people in it who want to cut the budget.
The fact is that none of the budget items were cut except in about four or five areas that are so unbelievably essential that you can't imagine the president would suggest them. He cut money for American agriculture. We had 30,000 farmers in Washington protesting the fact that they're losing their farms because they can't survive in an economy where the government is not letting them have a chance to compete. He cut money for small business. If there's anything in the United States that needs help, it's a small business community. That's where competition still works. He cut money out for disaster relief, and that's like predicting there are not going to be any disasters this year. What if there are? Then we as a people have to respond. You know that the Congress is going to restore those
figures. He put $2 billion of the disaster relief money off the budget by putting it in one of the agencies, Farm Home Administration, that might administer it. And that way, we're still got it, but it's not in the budget. That's an interesting gimmick right there.
Well, the fact is that the president's budget is in error by something in excess of $20 billion. It might be as much as $40 billion. Our deficit, if his budget is enacted this year, will be at least $87 billion deficit, maybe $100 billion. And yet, they refuse to even talk about the inflation impact on the American people when that happens.
You spoke of 30,000 farmers here, Bill. I'm surprised that the number is so low. I thought I had that many in my office.
You know, it's an interesting phenomenon, and the president mentioned it in his State of the Union message.
Mm-hmm.
Some of you may have seen us thumbing hastily through the manuscript to see where that reference to 5, 10, 15 fertilizer was, and it wasn't in there. The president extemporized that. And that was fine, except then to find that the budget is reduced is, I'm sure, a great disappointment to those 30,000 and to the millions around the country. But I've never seen a group of petitioners, of people who came to Washington to express their grievances and their distress, who were more sincere, who had hurt more clearly written on their faces and distress in their manner than these farmers. They really are hurting. They need help, and they need help right away. And I don't see help forthcoming in the president's program. Now, I favor the tax cut. I agree with Barbara. You've got to accompany it with restraints on spending. Right. But we've got to find a way to bring relief in two parts to those farmers. First, a short-term program that'll give them relief now in terms of the ability to continue in business, and the other, long-term relief that will stabilize American agriculture. I happen to think that a lot of the answer to that will come in reinstating our ability to sell American farm products abroad. I think our foreign markets are the salvation and redemption of American agriculture. But these folks need something now, and I find nothing in the president's program or in his budget that offers any reasonable prospect of improvement to the American farm.
Howard, one of the most alarming statistics I know of is that the amount of agricultural products which was sold abroad is down 10% from the Ford administration to the Carter administration. Now, this means to me that the people who are supposed to be selling American agriculture aren't selling it. And this has got to be one of the salvations of the American farmer.
But I hope we're not going to abandon small business either. Because you know now, in these days of technological development and everything, these small companies could be the beginning of an Edison, of any one of a number. And it's hard for them to find financing. They very difficult for them to get a loan. They are new. They need and above all, they need to stop some of the paperwork. We had a small businessman in our committee. He had 6 employees. He had 4,762 pages of forms to fill out. He had to send them to Ernst & Ernst or somebody. The deluge is impossible for them to keep up with it. And really, I think that, you know, something like 90% of the work of this country, the production, is small business. Still, we think of always the giants. Small business is at the bottom of it. And
well,
they are vital and violently important.
That small business.
You're just
the essence.
Absolutely. And if we could, you know, they just say to me 2 things. If you could just lay off all this paperwork, and if you could just leave us alone, have something stable for a while, even if we don't like a program, if you tell us it's going to be there for 4 years, at least we know what plan.
That's why we need legislative oversight, Millicent.
Common sense.
Well, Congress has to do that.
Isn't the point to be made, though, that the budget leaves out things that the president and his advisors know very well that Congress is going to put back? We're back in the old days of the demonstrative cut that we used to have in Lyndon Johnson's time, when he cut school lunches to show how parsimonious he was. And there was a great public relations effort made, apparently, at the time this budget came out, to get everybody to believe it was a lean, tough, conservative budget. And I saw that in the headlines across the country. In fact, if you put in the things that the president knows very well that Congress will put back, and he cut the ones he actually cut, small business, the disaster aid, agriculture, and veterans is another he cut.
That's right.
If you put just those items back, you've got an additional $7 billion accommodating for inflation. Got an additional $7 billion on top of the $61 billion deficit. And that's only the beginning. He set up a budget which may on the surface look tough and tight. But in fact, he hasn't cut anything that involves growth. He has cut instead things that he can count on the Congress to put back. And then he can claim, it wasn't my doing. If we have a great big deficit, more than we expected, it's the Congress's fault.
He's added a 20% increment to all of the Great Society programs. There are 24 brand new programs, but they don't count for much this year because, you know, they don't get expensive for the first 2 or 3
right.
years. But they get terribly expensive later on. But actually, the present programs of the Great Society were increased over last year by 20%.
Despite the fact that they didn't, in too many cases, work.
That's correct.
They really didn't.
That's correct. I want to make 2 points. I want to follow up on Howard's on agriculture. I think he's absolutely right, and I would categorize the administration's approach as looking through rose-colored glasses. The budget says they are by cutting what's going to be needed for agriculture, but actually, you know, when the farmers come in and tell you our wheat, in order to get into the country of Japan, let's assume it goes in at $2 and a quarter, before it gets to the Japanese consumer, Japan puts a tariff on top of it to bring it up to $5, because that's what it costs to raise wheat and comparable products in Japan. Look what they're doing with our farmers' product, picking up over $3 a bushel to their treasury to come over and subsidize steel and the other things that are putting our people out of work. Now, we need an aggressive policy by this administration in all aspects of importing and exporting of crops that are grown by Americans. Japan won't accept American beef yet, but we sure accept their Toyotas easily.
Well, Pete, I was thinking the other day on that subject that, you know, we accept an awful lot of restraint on our exports to other countries, agriculture in particular, but I was driving down the street in a big city the other day, and I saw a big sign for a Japanese camera, another for a car. I saw a Japanese bank that had a branch in this city. I saw another advertisement, so help me, for Japanese steel. And I thought, you know, this is the way I thought it might be if we lost the war.
Yeah.
But it's a sad state of affairs, but America's prime muscle, its ability to produce beyond our capacity and requirement in the sell abroad, is withering and dying. And I think agriculture is just symptomatic of it. I think energy is another field, Bill, where we've simply got to get away from the business of importing expensive fuel and not being able to export high technology as America is able to.
That's what
the energy. Discuss energy.
Well, we have to.
Yeah.
But the thing that really frightened me about the president's proposal on energy, which he continues to fight for, is that it has nothing to increase production. Nothing at all.
If it was completely successful, the American people could look forward to a future of increasing scarcity.
I think we'd look forward to the worst of both worlds. Barber, if you accept at face value the president's representation that what he wants to do is to raise the price of fuel, of gasoline, of natural gas, of fuel oil, to a fixed statutory price, but still not decontrol, return to a free market economy, he's giving you the worst of both worlds.
Absolutely.
I think he's giving you controls which always produce shortages in the long term. He's giving you controls at a very high price, but he's giving you no incentive, as the market system does, to produce our way out of this crisis.
And what he's saying is, in effect, that the American consumer is going to have to pay whatever the OPEC countries choose to charge.
And he's saying that he's putting his faith in wage and price controls instead of the American system, and I don't believe that.
Also, I don't think that merely making them more expensive is going to stop it.
No.
I went to the Belgrade conference on the way back through Rome. The roads of Italy are clogged with cars at $2.50 a gallon.
$2 a gallon.
And right. Belgium is the same, others who went on a conference told me. You're not going to stop people buying just because it's more expensive. You're merely going to kill the man who's trying to get to work, make it impossible to get to church, whatever you need a car for.
You're also going to discriminate against people in Tennessee.
Yeah.
Or other areas where you don't have mass transit. You know, in my state, there is no choice. You have to drive to work in so many cases.
But think what's going to happen to the cost of heating your house.
Absolutely.
And of producing anything that you produce with an oil-fired industry.
You know, it's easy to get excited about this, and I'm glad we are, because I don't believe there is any issue in this country, domestic issue, that's more fundamentally important than the resolution of the energy problem. But I must say, I think the president's energy bill, which he described once again in the State of the Union, John, is in trouble not because of opposition from industry or from us, but because it's a bad bill, and the Congress knows it's a bad bill.
It's a terrible bill. And actually, you know, we need to understand that not only is this an energy crisis, it's an economic crisis. Mm-hmm. When you have a $30 billion deficit in the balance of payments, largely caused by the $45 billion that you pay to import oil from the OPEC nations, you've got problems. Saudi Arabia said that they couldn't guarantee that they could supply us oil through the 1980s. They've got plenty of oil. What they were really saying was that they've got more dollars than they want.
That's right. They're not confident in our dollars.
Right. Pete was involved once again, as he frequently is, as an important young senator on our side, in the formulation of a Republican energy alternative.
That's right.
You know, I really do have an abiding faith in the concept that a party must propose a positive plan as well as uphold its administration position.
Howard,
we did that last spring.
That's right. But let me just share what's happening to us so all our American people will understand. The experts that we have talked to, and I think they're impartial, the Comptroller General, for instance, has assessed the President's package. Number one, if every conservation measure that he wanted was put in place, and I think Congress is ready to put most of them in place, we would still be short of natural gas and crude oil in huge amounts by the year 85, 87, 88, and throughout. Now, if you admit that fact, then what we're going to do in natural gas, just as an example, instead of paying Americans $2.50, $3 for natural gas, we're going to pay Canada, we're already paying them $2.10 and they're raising it all the time. We're going to pay Mexico $2.60 as a starter. We're going to pay Algeria $4.50. All that money is going out of our country.
And all beyond our control.
All beyond our control.
You know, it was a part of the Republican energy alternative that you have phased, gradual decontrol of prices coupled with an excess profit or
correct.
A windfall profit stock so nobody could gouge. But if you let these prices obtain from Saudi Arabia or Mexico or Canada, we have no control over that.
And Howard, also your tax was, there was a plowback in the event that people in the energy business chose to increase the investment that they make in producing more oil, more gas, or whatever, they part of the tax was forgiven. So you're actually putting the money, which people paid at the gas pump, into producing more energy, which would have the effect of increasing supply, which would reduce the prices.
Now, the president
was so sensible and nobody bought it.
The president's singing our song on taxes.
That's right.
And there's another stanza on energy.
Yes.
And if he'll just sing, we'll make him another seat in the choir.
Absolutely.
But we really need to get off the dime.
We may let him in the church after
a while. But, Bob, you know, we have got another aspect, and that's conservation. When he made that first speech last spring, I don't know about your district, Barbara, but my district responded 100%. It was really wonderful.
Indeed.
Saying, get behind the president. We have an energy crisis. Let's go. I think most people experience that. But I would think that should have been followed by a presidential request for every governor to come here and tell the American people on a television program nationwide what they were doing in their states to implement this. Some practical steps. No practical steps were taken. The public was better. In my district, we had an engineer, a volunteer member of the school board, who devised a method of cutting their $600,000 energy bill by $125,000 without spending a dime. Now, this is the kind of thing that ought to have been picked up and made much of, and the same thing we could do with hospitals and businesses.
I think you see the clearest distinction between a Republican approach and a Democrat approach. The president's approach has been to create a new bureaucracy, raise taxes massively on the American people, spend huge sums for the bureaucracy and all the regulations and controls, and not deal with the basic problem of production.
Practical problem.
His approach would raise taxes and raise prices and not increase any production. That means, as Howard said, that we lose both ways. Our prices go up, but we don't get any more. So we have condemned, if we adopt that approach, everybody that is now unemployed to staying unemployed, everybody that doesn't have an adequate job today to still never have an adequate job, because people aren't going to work in America unless they have the energy to provide them with jobs. That's what we're concerned about. We're not talking about oil companies versus gas companies or anything else. We're talking about human beings that need a decent chance to be employed in America, and they're not getting it because this government doesn't have the political will to face up to the fact that we don't have energy, and we're not going to get it unless we start producing.
And Bill, the people we want to help get employed, that are unemployed, are not going to be employed unless the American economy is growing. That's in the president's message. He's absolutely right. Our GNP must grow. It can't grow without substantial new production of energy. And we've got to bring alternates on board. We understand that. But the short term is to bring our natural gas that is within our country on board as fast as we can and get on to options. And on that score, when you start looking at the budget, you will find that on future, research for future alternatives, that instead of the budget being up, it's down.
One thing you said that I thought I wanted to comment on had to do with the creation of the Department of Energy.
You know, one of the reasons this president was elected was because the American people really wanted the federal government to be made more efficient, wanted it to be reorganized, and Congress has resisted Republican leadership in the direction of reorganization, and President Carter promised he would do this. The one big change we've had has been a new Department of Energy with a $10 billion budget. Believe me, that's not a step toward a smaller government. It is a very modest down payment, however, on the reorganization of the total government that we were led to expect from a Carter administration. I think we ought to get on with that. Maybe there's maybe progress is being made behind the scenes in reorganizing this government along functional lines. I hope, however, that we won't create a lot of new behemoths in the process, that we really will reorganize. And I must say I've been disappointed that nothing has come down the pike more quickly. Here we have a full year behind us, and there's very little to show for reorganization.
Oh, we're going to run out of time. You know, and I'm grateful to every one of you that no one has mentioned the Panama Canal. But I really think we should, just for a minute, because that also was an element in the president's State of the Union message that I think requires a Republican response. And it's the most difficult political issue I've come across in a long, long time. Pete knows how I've agonized over this subject. President Carter called me in August when I was at home in Tennessee and said the treaties are about to be signed. And I said, Mr. President, this will divide the country. It will divide my party.
Both parties.
It will be controversial in both parties and the Congress on both sides of the aisle. And I intend, for my part, to study this as carefully as I know how and to make up my mind as carefully as I know how and to make my recommendation to my party as carefully as I know. And I've done that now. And I happen to think that the treaties as drawn were unacceptable. That without amendment, they could not have passed the Senate. May still not pass the Senate, but had no chance to pass without amendment. I happen to think that amendments could be supplied which will give those extra guarantees the country needs. And I hope the president will accept those guarantees. I rather think he may, those amendments. He has not said so, but I rather expect he may. And then I hope that the treaties will be ratified. If the amendments are not accepted, I think the treaties will not be ratified. Now, it's a divisive issue, but it's not a Republican issue. The division is on both sides of the aisle, and I think all of us, Pete, who's on one side of the issue, and I'm on another, I think may agree that the important thing is to make sure that we arrive at a careful, reasoned, sound judgment, and it does not destroy either of our two great national political parties.